I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets.
Where is the gold?
This is the Gold News Letter podcast. Fergus Hodgson, your host. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like more precious metals, economic freedom, please do subscribe on whatever platform you're on. You can also go to goldnewsletter.com and get our newsletters. We have a repeat guest, John Fenech. He is almost 30 years experience in the financial sector. He is the president of Fenech Consulting, and he is now consulting two mining companies and a portfolio manager. So, John, as you said before we got started, this has been a tough summer for raising funds in the mining space or junior mining space. So not only that, we've just seen really, a lot of volatility. What have you done to address this? You know, what are you looking to do or in going to the final quarter of the year?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me back, guys. I really appreciate it. And we've been doing a number of things. I've said on numerous podcasts, including yours, that we've been short a number of things this year. We will not short our sector because even though it is shortable, I think it just looks bad for someone to be short a sector where they're making money from, right? So like I don't short anything in the mining space. I'm shorting emerging markets as the dollar rages higher. That is a wonderful trade. The EUM is the ETF you can use for the single. The EDZ is the triple, which is extremely dangerous. So I wouldn't recommend that for novice investors. But it's been one of our best performers this year. You know, if you look at how we construct a portfolio, as we've said before, we will hold things longer term, like 2 to 4 years as core holdings. But then we trade around the periphery. For example, we bought New Gold at 63 cents recently, NGD, and sold it all around 90, 91 cents because it was being gamed by the rebalance of GDX and GDXJ on September 16th, right? If you look at the chart, these people like Van Eck is a huge shop, right? They can't buy in a liquid stock in one day. So it's just my theory, but I think they'd buy it, you know, a number of days leading up to the rebound. And it does create a lot of volatility because, you know, it's a large amount of shares they have to buy if they take a position, right? You saw the opposite effect on SVM recently, which was Silvercorp, where they got removed from the GDX because their market cap dipped below 450 million, which is sort of the line in the sand there. And the stock had their biggest volume week in the last number of years. But look at it today. It traded beautifully here this week as silver has risen. And it's over 274, I think, a share now. So, you know, in just less than a month, you're seeing a lot of upside in some of these names.
Brian, how much attention have you given to that fact, the exclusion or inclusion in these indexes or in these ETFs impacting their prices and where there's just not sufficient liquidity to handle it?
Yeah, it is a big deal when you know it's coming like that, and either way, in or out of the indices. And it's a tough game to play those indices because the GDX and the GDXJ, of course, the GDXJ is supposedly the junior miners, but the bottom line is there's not much difference between the two indices right now. And they've kind of merged together a lot. And there are other indices that I follow that you can't necessarily trade, but use to track the markets. I focus more on the junior mining sector. So those indices are all just about all producers. So it's kind of a different game, but it can really hurt a company. There are companies out there that never recovered from getting banished from an index. You know, if it hits a company at the wrong time, it can really damage them for a very long time. So it is something you need to watch. And that's one of the things that I'm curious about too, John, because you're a noted value investor. And I think everybody in this market really has to be. The values are so extraordinary. And the sector is so cyclical. And if you know how to play those cycles, if you have the courage to buy at the bottom and, you know, the gumption to sell at the top, then you can, instead of being a victim of those cycles, you can leverage them. So at this kind of a really washed out bottom, nearly as bad as say 99, 2000 was, what are you looking for besides just low market cap companies? What characteristics do you think you need to look for, and what kind of pitfalls do you need to warn investors about?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question, Brian. I think let's start with the things to look out for. I think if you look at any company, at least this year, that has launched a PFS or an FS, pre-feasibility study or a feasibility study, their costs are going up, right? So everything has gone up exponentially to create a mine, and all the inputs that go into that. You know, we're talking 60 to 100% at least in a lot of the inputs, but the price of gold, let's say, has traded flat, right? So like, of course your costs are going to go up, but when those reports come out, it's a reason for people to sell. And it's been really detrimental to companies like Argonaut, Integra. There's a number of them this year that, you know, the last 12 months that have come out with reports like this. And if you look at Integra, ITRG, it just hasn't even recovered. It's still like in a downturn months after the fact. So I think that has been a really big dynamic that we warned investors about. As soon as I saw Argonaut in December of 21, I put out a note to all my investors and said, this is going to be a red flag. Any company putting out this type of report in 2022, we will not touch until the report comes out, and then we'll think about it. Another thing is debt, right? My track record only goes back to Jan of 16, but I've been an investor, as Ferg said, for almost three decades. So I've made mistakes in my career. And one of them when I was younger was not paying attention to debt on the balance sheet. Debt in a rising rate environment like this is extremely dangerous. And I'm not just talking about mining, I'm talking about every sector, because if you have to service debt at a much higher interest rate, it's a problem. And I think some of these companies are going to go bankrupt out there that got really over their skis in 2019 and 20. Let's say you're a cruise ship liner, right? I remember Norwegian, NCLH, they basically bought a new fleet like a year or so before COVID. It's something I'm tracking. I'm not shorted right now, but I have been short Royal Caribbean and Carnival and stuff because I just don't like that sector right now. I think, you know, they're doing like these two for ones and, you know, 30% off, 50% off. They never used to do this kind of stuff, right? So to me, that's something to watch. But getting back to the debt issue, look at our sector, right? Arcana this year, really disappointing. Great Panther, really disappointing. You can go down a list of a number of names, and I'm not trying to single them out. I'm just saying, you can get surprised and then you're basically just going bankrupt. And that's something that we've been fortunate enough to really avoid most of the year. But on the upside, let's talk about some positives, right? So management is our first screen always. We've said that on your show before. I just went to Beaver Creek in Colorado as well as Denver. I met with 35 different companies in about 8 days. And, you know, I had some wonderful meetings and some not so good meetings. And you walk away from that with an impression after a half hour of do you want to invest more here? And to your point, Brian, like, you know, I thought what you said about being a victim is interesting, because there are a lot of people that went over their skis in the summer of 2020 and are now holding those shares down 60 to 80% and saying, what happens next? You can't sit there and hope. That's not a strategy. You have to buy more here. If you had conviction then, you have to look at the story and say, what's changed in 2 years? And I don't know what the answer is to that. I mean, look at it for yourself, look through the news items, call the company CEO, right? But I mean, the bottom line is we buy 8 to 12 times on our names, right? We don't buy once like a lot of our competitors. I think buying once is really difficult because you could get your entry point wrong and then you're going to lose a lot of money for investors, right? So we buy 8 to 12 times on the way up and try not to be disruptive on the way out.
Yeah, because a big selling can destroy a company, and even you can't get out if you start an avalanche. But you had mentioned before we got on too that some of these companies out there have market caps not much far above their cash positions right now. And Is that something else you need to look at? I mean, how prevalent are those kinds of opportunities? And if you do find that, I mean, that can't be your only screen. What else do you look at?
Having cash on the balance sheet at this juncture is obviously a positive, because you know that they're not going to do a financing before now and say the end of the year. Fabled Copper comes to mind. You know, they've got, I think, roughly 3 million Canadian in the bank, and they're trading at a penny. I mean, it's like, what a great lottery ticket on copper with a guy named Peter Hawley who's been doing it 30 plus years, right? It's like, to me, it's gone from 5 cents to 1 cent, you know, with no bad news. And it's just lack of interest, you know? So you look at those opportunities and say, that's how I can make some of my money back where I lost money, you know, in the last year or two, right? It's like, if this goes back to three and forget about five, like you make, you know, 2x on your money from here, it's fantastic. So we look for people like Peter who have been in the industry a long time, Brian, that have operated much larger situations. You know, another one that comes to mind is Ian Berzins over at Braveheart. Like, he's been in the business a long time, ran Thompson Creek. If you remember Mount Milligan, you know, that was not an easy mine at all before it got bought by Centerra, and he was involved in that transaction. So I'm looking for someone on a 5 cent copper stock like that that can build something else, right? They've got a mill. Well, maybe they can rent the mill to someone or sell the mill to someone if they're not going to use it themselves. They've got equipment. They've got, you know, $240 million in a tax loss on the balance sheet, and they're at 5 cents. I mean, it's like, there's so many great opportunities right now in the junior space that, you know, we have to kind of hold ourselves back sometimes. So I think this environment to me is very different than in Jan of 16, when I was actually worried. You know, I didn't sleep very well in January of 16, because I was getting executed on things, you know, 8 to 10% away from the bid on certain days. You know, set a limit order, go do something, come back 2 hours, and you've got all these executions. And now I'm like, you know, things are so bombed out given the geopolitical situation we have now versus then, because the backdrop then, if you remember, Brian, there was nothing like what's happening now. There's no war in Russia. There's no possibility of China invading Taiwan. There's no interest rates raging higher. Like, This is just a great opportunity, I think, for investors to buy some things that are really, really cheap.
Yeah, I like the fact that you mentioned Fabled Copper, because I own that one personally. I haven't recommended it yet in the newsletter. But yeah, the market cap's only about less than $3.5 million.
And what was the sentiment coming out of Beaver Creek? I mean, like you said, there are just so many companies trying to make a pitch, and I guess too few people eager to receive that pitch. Do you want to comment on the battle or the tension at that event?
Yeah. I actually brought 8 investors with me from all over the country, one of which was a financial advisor. And I think he was one of maybe 3 advisors that was at the whole meeting. And, you know you're at the bottom, right? When advisors who advise people on billions of dollars have zero interest in attending anything and broadening their horizons and learning a new sector, right? It's like the sentiment was pretty poor, but it was very well run. I think that the CEOs are trying to do what they can. I think Humble describes the environment, you know, to me, in terms of how many CEOs were humbled by this move over the last 2 years. They didn't expect it. I think we've become extreme oversold in the sector.
The Gold Newsletter is proudly sponsored by Inventa Capital Corporation, a venture capital advisory firm dedicated to the acquisition and development of assets in the natural resource sector. Today, Inventa is one of the premier mining groups with a first-rate portfolio of companies and a world-class team.
This is the Inventa Capital Update. I'm so pleased to have Craig Parry. He is the executive chairman of Vizsla Copper, that is VIZSLACopper.com. They're on the TSXV as VCU. You can follow them on Twitter at VIZSLACopper, and they're also on LinkedIn. So there's a lot going on with the company specifically, but Craig, welcome. This is the first time we've had you on the show. Please tell us why you're bullish on copper. I mean, that's obviously the push in your latest press release, that you're optimistic about this project and the underlying find.
Yeah, great to be chatting with you, Fergus. Look, of course, copper, with the world sort of quickly heading into recession here, you know, never, ever good for base metals. However, What we do know is that grand macro theme of electrification of the planet isn't going away, and the world needs a huge amount more copper. Of course, we're producing about 20, 21 million tonnes per annum today, and forecast by 2030 that we're going to need about 27 to 30 million tonnes per annum. We can't see where that's going to come from. And if you go back 12 months, you'll see the lead economist from Trafigura saying that the copper price is on a one-way rocket ship to the moon. Now, we've had a little bit of a false start because of these sort of global ructions and macroeconomic issues around inflation. However, all things are pointing to much stronger copper prices in the not-too-distant future. And we think we're going to see probably 10, if not more, $10 per pound copper at some point in the next couple of years. So with that in mind, we've been trying to put our foot on as many pounds and tons of copper rich ore as we possibly can. British Columbia, central British Columbia, great place to do it, great place to build projects. I'm also the chairman of Skeena, and we're fast moving into development of our Eskay Creek project up there in the Golden Triangle, and we've got great relations with the First Nations there, the Tahltan, and the provincial government. And we can see that British Columbia, Canada has the opportunity to become the next Chile, if you like, a major copper producing area. Of course, there's a number of major copper producing mines here already. And so with that in mind, you know, we've done this deal with Consolidated Woodjam. We're very pleased to report that about a month ago. An extraordinary suite of projects. You know, Bill Morton, something of a legendary geologist and our partner on this project now. We are merging our two companies. We should complete that by end of year, early Q1 next year. And that transaction for our shareholders is phenomenal. You know, for about a consideration of $10 million, we're acquiring nearly a million ounces of gold in resources there and 1.7 billion pounds of copper. So, you know, to be able to do that at that price, phenomenal. And we're very pleased to be partnering with Bill and his team. You know, they're legendary. They've proved up a number of brilliant targets on the property in addition to the resource they've got. Never had much love from the market, and that's what we're doing a little bit differently, I suppose. We've got a great following. Of course, I was a founder of NextGen Energy, ISO Energy. We sort of delivered nearly $4 billion of shareholder value there. And then Vizsla Silver, of course, which we spun Vizsla Copper out of, you know, $300 million company. We've discovered a major silver district down there at Panuco in Sinaloa, Mexico. So we've got a tremendous market following, and all we're going to do now is alert the market to what Bill and his team have discovered out there in central British Columbia. And we're just south of Mount Polly and surrounded by some of the world's, or certainly Canada's largest copper projects. And suffice to say, you know, this gives us, for not much money, not much consideration, a very, very large resource base, but phenomenal exploration upside. And I'll get into that in a little bit as well.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. What flaws you've got both in your latest transition highlights, you mentioned that you've got expansion driven brownfield and also this discovery seeking greenfield. So do you want to clarify the two sides you've got going on?
Yeah, so look, we've got a big resource base there, and that gives us something that, you know, with the view that the copper price is going to be very, very much higher in the not too distant future, you want for your shareholders optionality over copper and over, you know, a large resource base, which we have here now. So that has tremendous fundamental underlying value. But the thing that excites me most is the exploration potential. And you know, the guys have drilled some truly spectacular holes, some of them very gold rich, that we think are completely open and never really been closed off or followed up. To give you an example, there was a hole drilled back in 2020 that I think the market just didn't appreciate at all, and that included 110 metres at 2.6 grams per tonne gold and 0.44% copper. And, of course, you know, one of the negatives or sort of a bad rap that British Columbia copper projects get is that they're low grade. Well, there you can see 110 metres at 2.6 grams gold and 0.44% copper. Obviously not low grade, very, very high grade for a porphyry system. And so, you know, we've got a bunch of exploration work to do. We'll start off with the basics and, you know, analysing all the data and looking at the geological model and developing an updated exploration model. But when you see those in a porphyry system, you know something's going on. And we've got to follow up those, and we'll be drilling there, I think, probably Q1 next year, in and around those sorts of drill holes. So you can bet that we're going to have some great results coming. There'll be certainly plenty of news flow. One of the great things about the area that we're operating in up here is that you can operate year-round. Very important to the market, being able to deliver news flow year-round. So we'll be doing that and following up some of those spectacular drill hits that the market really hasn't even noticed and appreciated. So, I'm looking forward to getting drill rigs on the ground and going on that front. So watch this space there. When we close the transaction, we'll be out there pretty quickly. We're also doing a property-wide ZTEM survey in the not-too-distant future, and that will prove up other targets, I think, that and help refine our exploration model. But suffice to say that the news flow will be very, very strong over the next 12 months as we hit the ground and get drill rigs turning. So I'm excited for that, Fergus.
Yeah, you mentioned here that you've got copper, gold, and molybdenum exploration going on. Do you want to mention the importance or speak to the importance of the latter?
Yeah, look, you know, there's a couple of, in these terrains, there's a couple of different systems. You typically get porphyry copper gold systems and then porphyry copper moly systems. So we've got both of those. What we think this is pointing to is that this area that we have covered, the Wood Jam property, is the nexus of a number of significant or major, really, mineralizing systems. And it seems to be a point where, you know, one of those rare points on the planet that have developed a large number of porphyry copper centers. You know, we know that the grade's very good. The guys have drilled out a major resource base there already. So really it's just about refining that. Of course, you know, we've got a huge number of targets there already. So you've got to go through, do all the basics, right? Rank and prioritize all of those and work out where you're going to get your best bang for shareholders' buck. In terms of drilling, and we're sort of zeroing in on those. And, you know, when you've got a drill hole like that 110 metres at 2.6 grams gold and 0.44 copper, you don't have to go too far away from that to know that you, when you start drilling, because you're obliged to follow those sorts of intercepts up. So, you know, fairly straightforward sort of process. I guess we'll, you know, we've got a great team up there, guys that have, Steve Blower, who's our head of exploration. Steve's becoming something of a legendary geologist himself, having discovered a number of major deposits around the world, including in uranium. So we've got a great team, and it's just a matter of working through those things. But suffice to say that we'll be delivering some pretty serious drill results at some point in the not-too-distant future when we hit the ground early next year.
Yeah, so, folks, the key point here is that Vizsla Copper Corp is acquiring Wood Jam Copper Corp, or Consolidated Wood Jam Copper Corp, and this should be all tidied away before the end of the year. You can, and then, so that's what he's referring to, the news coming out in the new year when they get, you know, when that's completed. So the website is vizslacopper.com. That's vizslacopper.com, and you can follow them on Twitter, vizslacopper. Also find them on the Toronto Venture Exchange, the TSXV, at VCU. Otherwise, Craig Parry, thanks for your time.
Fergus, really good to chat with you. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I heard that as well. And obviously, I've talked to a lot of mining companies, and the sentiment is at that bombed out level where people just put their hands up and saying, what else can happen? We literally can't go much lower because there aren't any sellers left. We're really reaching that point of selling exhaustion. Yet, as we speak, this episode will be coming out right, I guess, on the opening day of the New Orleans Investment Conference. And it's just a few days away as we talk. And we have a record number of companies. I mean, we're sold out on our exhibit hall. Our biggest attendance in years.
That's great.
Yeah, it is, but it's gotten me curious, you know, as to why. It's really counterintuitive and contrary to everything else we're seeing. You know, I guess it speaks a lot to the value of the event, but so I guess at some level, maybe there's companies there's a divergence out there. There's a separation that some companies are okay, have enough money and are still able to market. So maybe that's a screener that people can look at. You know, what are the companies that are out there still telling their story?
That's a good point. I, you know, coming from a marketing and sales background, I think it is important for companies to get their story out there, not just put it on social media necessarily, but do a number of different things and just see what works, right? You can't just keep doing the same things and expect a different result. So, you know, I think that's something that I coach CEOs on a lot is, let's try this, let's try that. Like, we have to try something different to get people to look at the story, because the news that I see is pretty darn good, right? And some of these situations, many of the situations in July and August were getting, there were reasons for people to sell, right? It's like, you know, good news comes out on a drill hole and people sell into the strength. And that's talk about counterintuitive. That's ridiculous. I mean, if you look at August of 2020, if you put out good drill holes, you're up 10% a day probably, right? Right now it's like you're down 3 to 5%. It's ridiculous. So, you know, we just tend to, again, coach clients on, if you bought something at 15 cents and now it's at five, buy it again at five. So your blended cost is 10, right? Like, so you have a chance to get back to par or make some money on this investment rather than just crossing your fingers.
Yeah, especially if you like the company. And you're right. That's what's happened. If a company puts out great drill results, then there is trading volume and it's a liquidity event and it's an opportunity for people who couldn't sell to sell. And good, you know, good. We don't want those people in the market if they're sitting ready to pull the trigger. Sentiment in the mining sector, it seems to me a lot of people argue or try to figure out what's going to change sentiment and talk about how bombed out it is and everything else. But it seems to me that it's really dependent on the metals and where they're going to go, that, you know, it changes in a flash. We saw that a couple of days where we had gold up $40 one day and $25 the next. I mean, all of a sudden, all of the clouds were gone and everybody was happy and jumping up and dancing jigs and everything else. So it doesn't take long, but when are we going to get that kind of a sustained rebound in the metals? What do you see as being a driver that's going to finally get us going again?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think the way I look at it is an outside event that people don't have on their radar, much like you saw in England last week, right? Where leverage is really destructive in the markets. And I think there's a lot more leverage in this global market, Brian, that people understand. And take a look at some of these financial charts right now. And I'm not trying to single out any one of these, but I looked at a few before we got online. Santander, which is a Spanish company, SAN, Credit Suisse, I used to work there, CS, many years ago. You know, these charts look terrible. And they look like they're almost trading like there's a problem. And I don't know what that problem is, but if you get one of those larger companies to go bankrupt or announce that they've got some serious problems and need, you know, a life raft, it is going to be an outside event that most people don't have on their radar right now. So we have been just starting over the last like 2 months to short financials and just very selectively. I like a lot of other areas in the market to short more than financials, but it's sort of like, wow, like everything is now, if you look at biotech, if you look at tech in general, certain sectors, you know, subsectors of tech, there's a lot of things that look possible for shorts here. So, you know, I feel like the market is really unhealthy here. And it's going to be, you know, what is going to turn that? Let's talk about the positive, right? So the positive is a Fed flip-flop, right? That's going to be your all-in moment. I would cover a lot of my shorts there and I would go heavy, heavy long, like everything, you know, because I've got a watch list like everyone else. But I feel that, you know, the Fed has been disappointing us all year by just continuing to hold true to their talk. And so until that changes, I'm not going to, you know, go put all my chips in. I did this in January of 2019. I watched what was happening with the Fed from the transition from Yellen to Powell. And then if you remember, Brian, back January of 19 at like a Yale or Harvard lunch, Powell just said, hey, you know, we're going to get more dovish in so many words. And that's when we went all in and we were up about 82% that year. So, you know, we're going to wait for that catalyst before we like go all in.
Yeah. You know, you talk about something happening, something breaking. I mean, we almost had the pension fund in the UK, as you mentioned, break. It was on the verge of breaking. It seems strange, and I tweeted this out the other day, that with this tremendously steep rise in interest rates, a lot of cracks appearing in the system. And it's just strange that we haven't had a long-term capital management or a Lehman Brothers moment yet. But everybody does seem to be kind of looking out for it and expecting it. Really at any point in time, that pension fund issue in the UK was something like that almost happening. Now we're looking at Credit Suisse and rumors are flying, and we're on some other banks as well. I mean, that could happen at any point in time. And a lot of people are pointing toward not so much the mortgage market like we had in 2008, or the banks themselves, because they've been shoring up a good bit. But it's the derivatives, I think, that everybody is really worried right now, because that notional value, that exposure, it doesn't begin with a T, it begins with a Q. You know, it is so large, it dwarfs everything. Nobody can really get their minds around it. That's something that could happen in a flash because it's all so interconnected.
Yeah. And you and I have been in the markets long enough to remember how 08 was, right? It was, I worked at Merrill Lynch up until 06 and I had a lot of stock, right? So when I left there, the stock, you know, the rumor was we were going to get bought by JP Morgan, and JP Morgan had a lot of cash on the balance sheet. You know, Stan O'Neill, who was CEO at the time, had a big incentive to do a deal somewhere. So the rumor was take out around 125. And so at about 90 bucks, I was like, you know what? I don't think that's going to happen. I'm not going to get greedy here. And it ran up above 100. So I missed a little bit, right? But then, as you know, Bank of America had to bail them out on a weekend in 2008. And it was because of the derivatives and the balance sheet that even I, as a senior executive, wasn't aware. And I can tell you all of my bosses weren't aware of. So if a company that large can, quote unquote, almost fail, like, I think there's a lot of companies that could fail, not just in financials, but, it, you know, throughout different sectors.
Well, one thing that Alan Greenspan actually told me in 2016 when we had him speaking, he pointed to that as the big issue, because post-2008, those institutions can't fail. They're in that too big to fail category. And that means that derivative exposure is backed by you and I, you know, by Uncle Sam. And so that's the key issue, I think, is that anything that happens to those banks will by nature become systemic, because we're all going to have to pay for it. And they're awfully big numbers. And, you know, again, it's dominoes. If one goes down, these derivatives are all interconnected. And they could all fall in order. So it's a crazy thing. Then, you know, that kind of financial turmoil is always resolved by more central bank liquidity. And it would be, you know, a liquidity vacuum for a while, but precisely what we're talking about, gold, silver, associated investments, yeah, those are going, the ones that are going to soar when people start looking at what the Fed policy is going to be.
Yeah, and just this week, I mean, silver up 9.1% in one day. When's the last time that happened? I mean, I'd have to go back and look at the numbers in March and April of 2020. Maybe it happened there one day or 2 days, but I mean, it's going back years previous to that. So
yeah, I think it was actually March 2009 was the last time we had a day like that in silver.
There we go.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. It was a lot of fun for a few hours.
It was a lot of fun. But I mean, you can look at some of those silver juniors that were up 10 to 25% that day, and that's where you're going to get your 2 or 3x leverage on the price of the metal. So to your point earlier about watching the metals, you know, if you're properly positioned in some quality juniors that have, you know, no hedging, you know, so they're fully exposed to the price of the metal, you know, that's where you can get some real upside, I think, in this at this point in the market. There's just so many bombed out names.
Yeah. So how do investors find those? What's their step one to do that?
I mean, it's a lot of work. I mean, the company isn't going to put on their website, hey, we hedge this much or whatever, right? So you have to kind of go into financial statements, you know, on SEDAR.com, or you can just go to their website. A lot of times their presentations, their quarterly, you know, earnings results will have that information in there. But, you know, you can just call the company as well and just say, are you hedging your production if you're a producer, and how much are you hedging, right? So like, I personally feel at this point in the cycle, I want full exposure to a move, you know, up in metals. So I don't tend to gravitate towards companies that are doing a lot of hedging, because I feel like we're really close to a near-term bottom here.
Yeah, you really need to focus. If you're going to be in the sector, you don't want companies that are hedged because you want to be fully exposed. And then there are people like Keith Neumeyer who occasionally holds silver off the market. Screw him. This is not a price I want to sell at, as much as he can, at least. So, you want people who believe in management that believes that they're not an industrial company. They're a gold or silver miner. And for a reason.
Right. Mate, we rushed through the half hour there. And to be frank, I got mixed messages that sometimes, I mean, there's a lot going on here. So there in some areas, like you said, there could be another catalyst, a downward catalyst. But at the same time, there's a great opportunity for sentiment to turn to the upside. So if you want to learn more from John Fenech, it is fenechconsulting.com. That's F-E-N-E-C-K consulting.com. Otherwise, we'll have all the show notes at goldnewsletter.com/podcast. John, thanks for your time today. Cheers.
Thanks, Ferg. Take care, guys.